listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void.
I was in the room, lying in the window chair. I was spread so thin, I was almost everywhere. Run through Gresham Park, Bowman's light upon his feet. Ghost drunk up with morphine, is it him or is it me? Grief versions, starling sky. Grief versions, starling sky. Edna's in the forest, in the snow black pocketbook. Silka stands before, stares the gun and cocks his look. The bird is frozen sideways on the roof, eternity. Some pressing in the distance like the sky upon the sea. Grief versions, darling sky. Grief visions, starling sky.
We were running through the Bristol woods, Mr. Bowman and I. His legs rose and splashed like fast liquid over the fallen trees. I could feel, but barely, through the frozen rigid bark of his skin, the whipping past thickets of the wild, winter-stiff weeds. 6 inches of snow on the ground now, and more falling in the twinkling darkness. There was no wind, just the scratching white lines of the snowflakes in a foreboding middle stillness. "Can you feel it?" Bowman asked. It wasn't a question, but a general heightening awareness, as a dog might bristle at some curious disturbance in the dread distance. Something beckoned. Something blurred and bothered the landscape ahead. Something other than Edna or the bird was calling for us. For me. Edna was somewhere in the nearby forest. I could feel her indistinctly, the cold cargo of her body splayed out in the snow. But the closer we got to the Bristol storage facility, the less contact I had. A soldier had raised his gun. His leather boots had creaked in the snow, and there followed a whoosh of silence. I did not think he had discharged his weapon, but I was not sure. And the bird, the black starling, quietly shocked in the fine snow of the gambrel roof, waiting for the men as they climbed the barracks ladder. To what? To kill him too? And why? What was so important here? What was the man who called himself Mr. Grave after? Occasionally in the distant periphery, I could see the silver splinter light of the moon shimmering off the ice of Lake Regent. Bowman's body was near its breaking point. His breathing had gone to a feather. His heart pounded a bloody mallet. As engine hot as he was inside from this exertion, his skin and the shell of his outer body was a thick slur of ice. His eyes were purpling with dizziness, and his arms dragged dead alongside us, too heavy and ice-laden to raise. He plunged to a sudden stop. We carried forward a moment into a stumble, and then he balanced and stood, and we tuned ourselves to the stillness around us. Our legs, blown to rubber, vibrated below us. the factory smoke of his breath pumped out white and chemical into the night air. His heart charged around his chest, berserk and wild for peace. And in the quiet strangeness surrounding us, the snowflakes rustled a blanket of tiny bells, and we listened. "What is it?" I asked. "Something here," he whispered back. "Something here." I suddenly had the impression that Bowman knew something. But how could he? Something was definitely amiss. Something mysteriously not right. As though the trees around us had been shorn from their roots and rearranged and propped up in a sick pantomime of a forest. As though the rocks and earth had been raked and shifted carefully to hide some sinister act. "What has happened here?" I whispered. "I am sorry," Bowman said. "I cannot hide it from you any longer. This is how it goes." I was not sensing what had happened, but what was about to happen. What Bowman had known all along and had hidden from me. Somehow. "How what goes?" I asked. An eruptive punch square upon his chest as the bullet hit. Bowman's heart swang for stillness. His breath foamed out and then clenched. There was a moment of brutal crisis, followed by disbelief as we toppled backward, like a skyscraper grasping into the making of its own dust. There was a terrible slowness and evaporation and recognition of a loss of connection between the mind and body. The body was gone from our use. The mind sat in its throne, waiting itself for dissolution. We lay in the cold snow. A small point of pain pried at Bowman's sternum, a yellowy star in the charcoal sky, a rushing smell of forest, of the oil of cold trees, of the sweet scent of ice, and the rich blood-iron smell of dirt. "I am sorry," Bowman said again, "but this is how it goes." He had known all along. How had our congruence been so incomplete? "What is the purpose of this?" I asked. "They want you," Bowman answered. His voice wavered in the space of our partial union. He was slipping the coil before me. The confetti of snow fell upon our face in endless lines. Our hands lay back in the rough mixture of ice, a taste of blood tucked against the glottis, a sense of the body still warm, but a stranger's body now, a fleshly blanket tightly wound around us. The star in our chest bloomed into a torturing sun, but the pain abruptly discharged. Now there was a feeling of sleep and downgoing, of indigo travel. We were on the black road, heading into the microsphere. "Where are we going, Bowman?" The place of the injury served as a kind of entryway, as though we were glissading through the bullet hole into the tunnel of the wound, and from thence onward along the black road, and thereunto dissolving back into the quicksilver. His presence dropped quickly from my awareness. Bowman had gone ahead into the tunnel, run off alone down the black road. I lay unaccompanied in the warm stone of his body. How strange to die like this, displaced, not at home, in a foreign land, as it were. But was I dying? The body was not breathing, the heart was not beating. Bowman himself had followed along the natural course of his demise. But I felt curiously fine, peaceful, quite alive, and as though not attached to his process. Not dead. Not dying. What would happen, I wondered. Would I simply remain here, entombed in the body, unescaped, held down in the snowy forest, pinned to the world and slowly merging into the soil? It was not bad. There was a beauty to it. A peaceful, comforting refrain struck up. I could live here, in the dead body, in the winter woods. I could live here, in the dead body, in the winter woods. I could live here, in the dead body, in the winter woods, forever and ever. But then I remembered. we had been shot, and whoever had shot us would certainly come along soon to make sure his intention was met. The eyes could not move, and their power was dull, but I could shift my focus. There were men coming down through the woods. The ears had lost their value, but the eyes still printed the color and line of the world. Boots struck down beside my face. The world went a kilter as Bowman's dead body was brought into standing. I was looking at the trim, old, devilish man in the charcoal suit and derby hat, who had escorted Edna from her storage room. A dark man, his mercury eyes pulsed under his silver glowing spectacles. "My name is Mr. Grave," he said. A soldier stepped forward, carrying Edna. She looked alive, if unconscious. "Take her home," Mr. Grave ordered. He stepped forward, put his hand under our chin. "I know you're in there," he sang with malice. "The woman will be fine, not that it matters. And so too the bird. We're all fine, aren't we? Except for Mr. Bowman. But he's fine in his way. We wanted you, and now we have you. We try to interfere, as little as possible now, with the distant and pleasing end, that we may interfere as much as possible later." He sounded a grim laugh. "We are that careful. We walk that softly. I just wanted you to know." He removed his spectacles and looked deeply into my dying eyes. "All fine indeed. Are you ready, my friend?" Mr. Grave asked. "Ready for what?" I wondered. Mr. Grave nodded to the soldiers. The two men holding Bowman's body now dropped it roughly in the snow, and my vision flew to the night sky. The soldiers retreated into the nearby darkness as Mr. Grave knelt over me. "You may come now to me," Mr. Grave said, "or I will come to you." His right hand moved over Bowman's unfeeling chest. "I sense some resistance, sir," Mr. Grave said. He pushed a finger downward into the cavern of the injury. I could feel his invitation drawing toward me, a siren's call, a wickedly sweet summons. All I had to do was lean into the space of his request. But it was a dark thing, a cancerous leech. He exerted himself suddenly downward, cleaving his hand through Bowman's bullet-shattered chest. His face closed in just over mine, insidious, tortured, content. "Can you feel how close?" he whispered. "Coming down the walkway for you, coming down the short hall, into the little room, into the secret closet, in the box there, in the box inside the box, to the pretty diamond heart." There was a new fresh coldness around me, a chemical frost, and then a sudden warmth, a shocking brightness, an explosion of vibrancy. I was kneeling downward over Bowman's body, my right hand plunged deep into the still warm chamber of his chest. "There we are," Mr. Graves said, pleased at his excavation. "I have him," he announced. He pulled his hand from the difficult hole, shook it once over the snow, spraying out a crimson speckling on the white floor. "My gloves," he called. The soldiers crunched forward over the snow from their retreat. One of the men swabbed a towel over the bloody hand, while the other quickly fitted the gloves over Mr. Graves' fingers. The same soldier then drew our hands tight behind our back, and I heard the soft lock sound of handcuffs. "What's happening?" I asked, but there was no answer for Mr. Grave. We were being escorted through the woods. Why was Mr. Grave now being treated like a prisoner? "Where are we going?" I asked. Mr. Grave, however, had erected a wall of blurring fury that I could not penetrate. I was alone inside him. Yet I was still in touch with his body, and by the strain on his face and the hunch of his shoulders and the stiff rod of his spine, I could tell that he was using a good deal of his available energy to keep me distinct and at bay within him, a great physical effort to block me. They were taking no chances, I realized, but that's important. That's what this means. They don't know what can happen. That's why we're handcuffed. Mr. Grave had shifted my essence into his possession. But he is not sure, or they are not sure, whether he can maintain it. We were walking through the compound now. There were soldiers in front of the barracks. We turned down between two large outbuildings and approached a long black sedan. Smoke pushed from its tailpipe, and I smelled its acrid diesel fumes huffing from the undercarriage. The wipers furiously swept at the snow. A rear door was opened, and we were sat inside. An additional shackle went around our ankle and clicked into place. With that, Mr. Grave relaxed his guard. "I have you!" His voice shook with the victory. His fist tightened, and he punched down into his thigh, triumphant. The importance of my capture sent me reeling, and did not follow. What could be vital about taking possession of me in this way? The wall he'd set up between us suddenly dropped. "You will be maintained like this into perpetuity," his voice said. "I am the Bilderberg Silke, and you are my charge. You are my point, and my destiny." His voice fell off. "My life is at its climax. This is the moment I've waited for all along. I was designed to hold you, trained to keep you, and I am quite happy that I will be able to report that you will be my forever, my very special prisoner." car pulled away, rushing and fishing over the thick and rutting snow. "Where are we going?" I asked. "France," Mr. Grave answered. "Belgium, Germany, Liechtenstein." "I do not understand," I said. "That is the point, my friend. You and I will be spending the duration of our time together. I know many, many things that I cannot allow you to know. Thus, I have been, manifestly, incorporated with prevarication." I did not quite understand him, and he felt my confusion. "You'll find in me a jungle of lies, because it is not possible to sustain, for any long period, a wall or separation from your knowingness. I have spent most of my life training in the genesis of untrue experience. I am steeped in self-created lies. Thus, when we are together, as we are now, you will soon notice that you are not able to detect what is true and actual from what is false. Reality will shift as I bend it. Your perceptions, as distributed via my conduit, will no longer feel valid. The physical world will be shattered. You will perceive a constantly changing version of reality. Put it to the test if you like. Tell me where we're heading." I went into the softness of his thought, and with some satisfaction I detected the certainty of our destination, the quiet assurance that we were headed to France. But just as I was about to reveal my detection, the sense of the place itself changed. Sweeping, melting images of Paris, Luxembourg, Berlin overlaid one another. "I cannot tell," I said. "We are going," he said, "to Liechtenstein, and that is the truth. But you will not remember that in the next few minutes, because, as I said, we are going to Berlin." The car moved swiftly now down the highway. There was the faint light of dawn burgeoning in the distant horizon. Mr. Grave seemed quite pleased with himself. He looked at his watch. 4:56 a.m., he said. He blinked, and the time changed. "Oh, look, 7:04 p.m. He blinked, and the time changed yet again. "I am a safety deposit box of a very special kind," Mr. Grave said. "If you think I'm bragging, I am. I deserve it. I am almost 80 years old, and I've spent my entire life specializing for this. I have the right to be proud of my hard work, of my achievement. It is the highest honor to be the Bilderberg Silke, to be the keeper of one such as yourself. An onerous and dangerous duty, it is well understood by my colleagues. They hold me in the highest esteem. To know the truth, and yet not. To know so many versions of the truth. To have built, and to be always building, a vast empire of dishonesty into one's core synapse, and to value them all intrinsically, and to attach as much meaning to a lie as to the real thing, and to almost not know the truth oneself, to almost not know. Right on the precipice of insanity, that is power. Can you not feel that power?" "Why, tell me," I asked. "Because your confusion will tire me, will bore me. It is my goal in this initial period to break you, if you will, to persuade you that your best course and the best life remaining you is a subdued and surrendered one. In giving you the ground rules, telling you who I am and what I am capable of, that you are locked inside me, that you will never get out, that you will never even know why you are being kept, that you will never be able to discover the final truth of why, or how, or who, and lastly, that I can create for you the most powerful hell imaginable. It will be written, and it has been written. The Bilderberg Silke is the keeper of the exponent of Westbrook." I could feel suddenly a cascading barrage of possibilities, multiple versions of the truth and their regeneration springing into focus all around. Even as we sat in the car, he was establishing alternative perceptions. The car goes off into the bushes. The car runs out of fuel. The car is red. The car is blue. The driver has a heart attack. It's too warm in the cabin. Too cold. There's a scent of juniper and gin. A scent of strawberries and chamomile. Of dead flesh and rotten meat. The seatbelt is on. The seatbelt is off. The interior is dark. The interior is leather. The interior is plush. Every moment he invested with an imaginative surge that camouflaged and covered the real, the actual. Even now, with his dissembly, I realized that by the end of our ride, that I would not, in looking back, be able to properly recall what had transpired. Had we crashed, run out of fuel? Were the seats leather? Was our seatbelt fastened? Was the car blue, black, red? The dreamy substance of the omnipossible is what he made manifest. Grave versions, he whispered. There's nothing you can do about them. If you resist, I will make it worse. I will double my efforts and drive you quickly into madness. If you do not, you may live comfortably alongside and within me until my natural death. And when I die, I take you with me. Above all things, I take you with me. That is my most precious, my most excellent talent, the thing I am most proud of. The car stopped. A man opened the passenger door. I noted that we were not, after all, shackled to the seat as I had originally thought. As I stepped out onto the runway, I also understood. This was not a car, but an airplane. For my benefit, Mr. Grave turned and looked back at the vehicle. I saw the train door shut. We were in a railway station. A mild panic flooded through me. "Where are we?" I demanded. "Welcome to Liechtenstein," Mr. Grave said, stepping over the hard tarmac. A light rain was falling here. There was a sharp, watery smell of airplane fuel, and the distant forests were a dark black green, high, sharp mountains in the distance. "Welcome to Berlin," Mr. Grave said. "Welcome to Moscow." Fear stabbed at me. Severing the connection between myself and reality was the foretaste of madness. A car waited 30 yards from the parked plane. It seemed to me the same car, the same driver as before. Had we not just ridden in this car? I smelled its diesel fumes, then, too, the smell of gin and juniper. "Where are we heading?" I asked, desperate for something to grasp a hold of. But in the next moment, we stepped from the car directly down a vast staircase. "Where?" I asked. "Where?" I was begging into the nauseous pain of my bewilderment. A single image suddenly came to mind, of an enormous stone castle on a mountainside. "Are we in the castle?" I asked. "We are home," Mr. Graves said. But there was no feeling in the body of arrived contentment. He reached up and pulled a long rope cord. High above us, 20 or 30 feet, a single grey bulb glimmered. We looked around. The floor was rough dirt and rocks. Something leaked in the far wall, and a muddy rust stream cut the room in half. There was an old brown pile of burlap and some broken bottles and a beaten tin of kerosene in the only visible corner. "It's a dungeon, but we can call it a basement if you like, or our bedroom, or the galley, or the attic." Mr. Grave went to the stone wall. He took off his coat, dropped it to the floor. "Keep the coat on," I urged him. It was cold. He took off his shirt. The chilling air attacked his skin to goose pimples. He turned around. "Is there not heat here?" I asked. "A stove or a furnace? We could make a fire. There's a tin of kerosene in the corner. We could have a fire." He took off his shoes, his socks, his feet already yellowing with the cold. "Why so cold?" I asked. He removed his pants. "Bedtime," Mr. Grave announced. "I will fight this, and I will not stop," I shouted. "This will not be tolerated." The dirt was coarse and wet and studded with shale. He lay down in it. The stones cut at our backside. The damp of the floor quickly crept up into our skin. "What are you doing?" I cried. "What is this?" "Good night, Sherwin," he said. We lay on the sharp, damp, cold dirt floor, naked beneath the single grey bulb. In the distance, I heard his cruel voice battering the darkness. "Welcome home, Sherwin. Welcome home." "There's kerosene in the corner," I shouted, "and I will find my way." "Welcome home," he said again. The rocks beneath us sharpened. The air froze solid. Our body began to shake in an epilepsy of merciless shivering. I took hold of myself. I wanted him to have one clear communication, not tinged with fear. "I will burn you to the ground," I whispered, and I felt him recoil at the power of my intention.
probably come to die in this town. Live here my whole life. Never anything to do in this town. Live here my whole life. Never anything to do in this town. Live here my whole life. Probably learn to die in this town. Live here my whole life. Nothing to do, sit around at home. Sit around at home, stare at the walls. Stare at each other and wait till we die. Stare at each other, wait till we die. Probably come to die in this town. Live here my whole life. There's kerosene around.
Adams, Motion, and the Void.